Continuing education credits, including ABP maintenance of certification for physicians and other healthcare professionals, are provided by the Penn Medicine Continuing Medical and Interprofessional Education. Check out our website at www.thecribsiders.com for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed in this podcast are solely of those of the hosts.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris, the Chief Manchu. I'm joined tonight by my co-host, Sam, as well as our producer, Juliana. Hey, guys.
What's up, Chris?
Tonight, we have our guest, Dr. Ava Catanaccio, to discuss infantile spasms. But first, Sam, do you want to remind us about the show?
Absolutely. So we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the fields to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering lingering questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We have a fantastic conversation with our guest, Dr. Catanaccio, a pediatric neurologist with the Division of Neurology at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She specializes in infantile spasms and will teach us how to recognize when to be suspicious of a seizure in an infant, including how a skin exam could be useful, how it could never be wrong to get an EEG, and the goal is early effective treatment.
All right, welcome back. I have Dr. Ava Catanaccio. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
First, before we're an informal group, is it okay if we call you by your first name?
Yes, of course.
All right. So because you're new to our show, we want to start off with some, you know, easy, rapid-fire questions just to get to know you a little better. So could you tell us like a couple sentences about who you are, what you do, and maybe something outside of medicine you like to do?
Sure. So I'm a pediatric epileptologist. I work at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. I've been on faculty, I guess, about 4 years now. And I live just outside of Philly in New Jersey with my husband and our two kids. And outside of work, I'd say my interests include learning how to cook. You should have known that already, but as many people in medicine will know, it's a long time before you have time to focus on other things. So I am learning to cook at, I will not admit what age I am, but as a fourth year attending, so like a PGY 10.
You know, I think that is a lifelong learning situation. You know, we talk about medicine all the time. Okay, lifelong learning. I think cooking falls right under that category as well. Anything that you recommend right now or things that you are currently cooking that we should all try?
Oh, I actually just checked out a cookbook from the library. It's a New York Times, like, quick and easy weeknight dinner recipe. And I've only had one flop, which my husband called the feet bowls. But other than that, every recipe has been great. So that's really helpful. It's easy recipes that I've been making for my family on weeknights, and so far so good. So I would recommend that book.
What book is it?
It's the New York Times, it's like 100 weeknight recipes or something like that. Should I look it up, actually?
No, it's okay. We'll throw in the show notes. You do want to look up cookbooks. So a couple of years ago, Justin Burke, who helped found this podcast with me, after he got married and he was talking about trying to learn how to cook, I sent him one of my favorite books, which is called How to Cook Everything by Mark Bittman. He was also, he was for New York Times. And it's just a great, they're not always just recipes, but like just for how to think about recipes. So you can start off with the basic and make things all sort of your own thing. So it's also a highly recommended cookbook on my shelf.
It's the last thing I'll torture with you guys about, but it's so funny. So I have a wonderful mentor who's a senior faculty member, and actually probably one of the greatest mentoring sessions that she and I had was where I sat down with her and we talked about how to figure out what to make for dinner every night. She also is a mom with many children, and we had like about half an hour where she walked me through what she's done over the years to survive as a attending, you know, an ambitious attending, and also as a parent. And so I just really appreciate alternative career mentoring.
Oh, that is awesome. That's a great idea.
That's real. That's as real as it gets. We love it. All right, Juliana, you want to ask the next question?
Yeah. Ava, what is the best advice you've ever received?
I think some of the best advice I received was actually from my own mother, who is also a physician. And she told me two things. One, to postpone having children until I was done with training, which obviously is not realistic for everyone. And then two, to work part-time. And so I've been working part-time since I started, maybe a year after I started at CHOP. And I love it. I have Fridays off and I have a great time. I exercise, I run errands. When our kids are in daycare, my husband and I like go out to lunch, we go to the symphony. And so I've been extremely happy with my work-life balance by just taking a little bit less time and having some more freedom. So I highly encourage folks when you're thinking about your career to really strike a balance that gives you time to do the things that you love to do outside of work too.
And I think that, you know, in medicine is one of the few jobs where you can work as a partial a point something FTE, as they would say, but essentially working part-time and doing that for a long time. Maybe some careers might not give you that opportunity or hire you to do so, but medicine often will. And so that, for all the training and all the hours we spend, we might have a lot more longevity if we get to do that. I will not tell anyone how much I'm working right now, but I do see that in my future. So I appreciate the advice. Hey, CroupSetters listeners, ready to discover physician opportunities in Northern and Central California with the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente? Join us in New York City as we host informational sessions on Thursday, August 20th, Friday the 21st, and Saturday the 22nd, as well as a social mixer at the Castell Rooftop Lounge on Friday, August 21st. You'll get FaceTime with medical directors, physicians, and recruiters as you explore career opportunities with one of the largest medical groups in the nation and have a chance to ask real questions before making a move. Interested in learning more? Visit northerncalifornia.permanente.org and RSVP today. Not in the New York area, but want to join thousands of physicians who have made TPMG their career destination? No problem. Visit northerncalifornia.permanente.org. Your practice, your future. Discover TPMG in Northern and Central California. All right, let's get into this case from Cashlack Children's. We got some awesome stuff to talk about. Juliana, you want to take it away?
Yeah. So you are a frontline practitioner in the emergency room meeting a five-month-old ex-full-term baby named Andrew. Parents are bringing him in because they notice that he's been making, quote-unquote, weird movements. For the past few weeks, he's been having episodes of repeated full-body jerking, movements that last for several minutes at a time. They're becoming more frequent, now happening several times a day, most often occurring after he wakes up. Mom's taken several videos on her phone and shows you one of the episodes. The video shows Andrew lying in bed and intermittently stiffening and bending at the waist. You see several one-second episodes, after which he begins to cry. Otherwise, Andrew is a healthy, full-term baby born via spontaneous vaginal delivery, uneventful newborn nursery stay, and was discharged home without any time spent in the NICU. Developmentally, Andrew could initially roll over after just 4 months, but over the last month, he's been losing that skill. Our first question is, when are you concerned for a seizure in an infant versus what would you call like a weird baby movement?
Yeah, so that's a great question. This is a really wonderful classic case in peds neurology. So seizures in babies can look very different from seizures in adults. And so I think a lot of time when parents, especially if kids who are at high risk for seizures, kind of receive counseling about seizure risk, it's important to review what they can look like. And so I'll try not to use this word too much, but when we think about seizures and how they look and what the body is doing when someone's having a seizure, we use the word semiology to describe kind of the appearance of the movements. And so when we think about adult seizure semiology, typically, you're thinking about a convulsive seizure, or generalized tonic-clonic convulsion, so whole body stiffening and shaking. In babies, that's usually not the way that seizures present. Often, they'll have more what I will call focal seizures, so seizures that start in a part of the brain and often have motor manifestations or movements that can be associated with one part of the body, so just jerking on one side or just jerking of one limb. And then there are also a type of seizures called spasms or epileptic spasms, where they will have a little bit like what you described that patient having, kind of rapid jerking movements where you'll have the arms kind of go out and up, the head drops down, and the baby kind of crunches. And that's a very unique seizure semiology that's mostly seen in infants, rarely in older kids, and is kind of often seen with a condition called infantile spasms. And then other seizure patterns can also be variable, but I would say that those are kind of the two big ones to look out for in kids. Now, in terms of other kind of odd movements that kids do, there are many. And I would say in my day-to-day practice of seeing funny baby movements, I mostly see reassuring ones where the kids are doing totally fine. Things that I think are important when parents say them. So anything that happens when the child is excited, when the child is eating, or when they're in their high chair, typically I found is not a seizure. One of my colleagues and I sort of have a running plan to write a paper on the high chair sign to see what the positive predictive value or negative predictive value, I guess, of events that happen in the high chair, because most of the time that's just kids getting excited and eating. Other things that are sort of red flags are movements that cluster that are very stereotyped, meaning they look the same every single time. And they can be associated with like a sleep-wake transition. So either falling asleep or waking up. And certainly if something's becoming more frequent, that's also concerning. And then the last thing that you mentioned in that case that really should raise your antenna is the fact that the child has lost developmental skills. And regardless of whether or not a child is having abnormal movements, anytime you have a young child who's losing skills instead of gaining them, that is a pediatrician, pediatric neurologist really needs to concern you, because that is obviously not what's supposed to be happening. So
one is, I think we should work on trademarking high chair sign, because I think that sounds like a great one. From a practical standpoint, what I find interesting is, you know, especially how we practice medicine is now different than just several years ago or several decades ago, is that the parent sort of came in with these videos, so they don't always have to try to describe these things. Is this something that you routinely recommend? Like, you know, for me as the pediatrician, you know, I get a phone call from a mom, you know, it's late at night, baby seems okay, but they're like, hey, they're doing these things. You know, is this something that's reasonable to be like, hey, every time the baby is doing this, can you make sure you record a video? And then when you bring them in, I can look at that and then try to then describe it the way you sort of discussed? Or is this not that useful because you're just going to do other tests?
No, actually, I think home videos have completely revolutionized pediatric neurology. They are incredibly useful. I think a lot of times, you know, just based on a description, especially with something like infantile spasms or pediatric seizures, you can get misled. And I've definitely have that, where I've had even older patients whose parents have described seizures to me. And I'm like, well, I don't know. That doesn't sound like it. And they send me a video and I'm like, oh my God, that's exactly right. That's what that is. So I do think home videos are very helpful. I also think it's very helpful for families that so many things are available online themselves. I have had so many parents who have seen their baby do something, done some light Googling, and actually come across infantile spasms themselves and been like, yeah, I think that's what that is. And what we've seen is, especially over the last couple of years, that sort of time to presentation to medicine is going down and down and down. So instead of these kids coming in a couple of weeks after the spasms start, they're actually presenting within a day. If maybe a couple of days. And even in situations where they've seen health professionals who have kind of turned them away and said, no, it's probably just a motor reflex or it's a normal baby movement, I think because of what the family has seen and what they have researched online, they are empowered to be like, no, this is very concerning. And so they'll often, you know, those are kids who show up in the CHOP ED not infrequently. So.
So those sound like fantastic tips to look for patients with abnormal movements that we really are going to be concerned about, either seizure or spasm. I was just curious if you had any tips for us to be like, oh, this is really reassuring. You know, we're talking about the weird baby movement that's reassuring. Is there anything to be like, oh, that's automatically, that's fine. Don't worry about that. It's like in cardiology when they say, okay, what I'm hearing is that musical murmur, and I know that that is a, that's benign. Is there any tips that you can give us on that front?
You know, it's hard. I think it's something that comes with a lot of experience. I must say, I think having your own children also helps, because then you get to see how over development children's movements go from being quite sort of herky-jerky and just uncoordinated to being much smoother. And so that I think can sometimes throw, especially first-time parents. I would say that the literature would suggest that actually both untrained and highly trained people are quite bad at identifying baby seizures. So what I always tell the trainees and the general neurologist is, if you're concerned or family's concerned, you know, EEGs are not harmful. And if you're, you know, if it's happening frequently enough that we can catch it, like, let's just characterize it. Let's see what's what. And then we can all feel better. And so I have a pretty low threshold for getting EEGs for funny baby movements, because so many of these are sort of must not miss diagnoses. So certainly there are parents who I've seen videos and have been like, nope, that's totally fine, don't worry about it. Or I've seen the kid do it. Like I said, typically context is really important. So, you know, it's happening during breastfeeding or it's happening right around eating, or they can kind of bring it out. If they can do something that brings out the movement, then that's usually pretty reassuring. But overall, you know, reasonable to err on the side of caution and get additional testing if, you know, if there's a concern.
That makes so much sense. Are there components of a neurologic exam that could help with differentiating whether or not the infant had a seizure or if it's a reassuring movement?
So probably not specifically if there was a seizure, but your neurologic exam is extremely helpful in thinking about seizure risk. So in thinking about several different components of the exam, one really important component is your skin exam. So your nervous system and your skin arise from the same embryonic tissue, which is the ectoderm. And as a result, you can have what are called neurocutaneous disorders that affect both the skin and the brain. And so the classic one when we're thinking about infantile spasms is tuberous sclerosis. And so children with tuberous sclerosis will have overgrowths in the brain called cortical tubers, and they will have abnormal skin findings where you get hypopigmented areas called ash leaf spots. And they have some other findings, including eye findings. And so if you see those on exam, then you should raise your concern that this child is at a high risk for seizures. So that's like a very specific one, just thinking about infantile spasms. That's one of the leading causes of infantile spasms is tuberous sclerosis. Otherwise, you really want to do a good developmental assessment. So looking for things like tone. So babies who have abnormal muscle tone or who have abnormal responsiveness, you know, aren't tracking, aren't fixing, aren't following with their eyes, are really loose and floppy, are much more likely to have an underlying neurologic condition than a child who's really robust and is otherwise kind of, you know, holding their head up, meeting milestones, et cetera. So I think that can really raise a red flag for if there's an abnormal neuro exam and an abnormal movement, okay, you should be much more thinking this could be a seizure. Whereas if you have a completely healthy, great looking baby, you know, who's like in there gurgling and laughing and appropriately, you know, interacting with you, and maybe they did these funny movements, you can be more reassured.
That makes a lot of sense. You know, you kind of already alluded to this already about, okay, who are we going to order this EEG on? You said there's kind of a low threshold to ordering because, well, it sounds like if your risk factors are high, for example, that might be helping you, or just we're not that good at this. So like, let's just put on the test. So I guess this is a two-part question, which is number one, who do you recommend the EEG for? But then also like which EEG are you recommending? When do you do spot? When do you do continuous? How long do you do continuous for? All of those types of things, if you wouldn't mind walking us through.
Yeah. So, and I'll just say, you know, for anyone who's not familiar in the audience, EEG or electroencephalography is basically a brainwave test. So you put an array of electrodes on the head and you're measuring brain electrical activity. It can be useful both in terms of characterizing the background brain activity, so what's happening when a patient is awake or asleep, as well as actually characterizing what's happening during abnormal movement if you're lucky enough to catch it. And so for seizures, that's really important because you can both have in-between seizure interictal abnormalities, as well as actually capturing the seizure itself when it occurs if the child's on EEG. This is a little background on EEG. In terms of deciding who to EEG, like I said, certainly if infantile spasms is on your differential, I would say you are obligated to get an EEG, and ideally an EEG that captures sleep. So I would say that most of these kids end up getting admitted to the hospital and put on continuous EEG monitoring with video because you capture sleep overnight. They wake up the next morning, they have a cluster of spasms, and you can diagnose them on morning rounds. So that would be sort of the typical flow, I think, for most spasms patients. Now, sometimes you will encounter these kids in the outpatient setting, and sometimes you'll end up having gotten a spot routine EEG, which typically does not capture sleep. If you have a very low index of concern, that sometimes can be good enough. But typically, I would say if you are actually concerned about spasms, these kids should have EEGs that capture sleep. In the outpatient setting, there's also something called a four-hour EEG, and this may vary from institution to institution. But the idea there is that at least you're capturing, you know, in a typical under one-year-old, you can capture a sleep cycle in there and reassure yourself. And the kind of background EEG feature that you're looking for with the condition like infantile spasms is something called hypsarrhythmia, which is basically just a pattern of high amplitude, meaning high voltage or height, brain activity that's very chaotic and disorganized with multifocal abnormal epileptiform discharges. And that sort of pattern is classic for hypsarrhythmia. And it's something that typically starts in sleep and then can eventually take over the entire background brain activity. And you'll see that in addition to seeing actual infantile spasms themselves.
One of the hardest parts of working in medicine is that even when I have the best intentions, eating well can be one of the first things to fall apart when life gets busy. After a long day at the hospital, the last thing I want to do is go grocery shopping, figuring out what to make, and then spend another half hour cooking and cleaning up. I want to eat real food. I just don't always have the time or energy to make it happen. That's why I've been really appreciating Factor. They make chef-crafted, dietitian-designed, ready-to-eat meals so you don't have to choose between eating real food and convenience. Factor meals are ready in about 2 minutes with no prep and basically no cleanup, which makes a huge difference on those days when my schedule is completely out of control. And I like that there's lots of variety. Every week, there are more than 100 nutrient-dense menu options, including things like salmon burger, shredded pork, collard greens, and plenty of other options. They also have add-ons like protein shakes and even pumpkin-flavored cheesecakes, so you can round out your meals without having to make another trip to the grocery store. Personally, I tend to gravitate toward their high-protein meals, especially after a long hospital shift when I know I need something filling, and I still really like their vegetarian options, which makes it easy to mix things up throughout the week. The whole thing just removes that mental load of figuring out what's for dinner, which honestly is one of my favorite parts. So I use Factor, and I think you should too, and if you're trying to eat a little better but your schedule makes cooking difficult, Factor makes it so much easier to actually follow through. So Cribsiders listeners, let's eat real. Head to factormeals.com/cribsiders50off and use code cribsiders50off to get 50% off and one free breakfast item per box for 1 year while supplies last until 10/31/26. That's code cribsiders50off at factormeals.com. Cribsiders 50 off at factormeals.com. See website for more details.
So a quick follow-up is what, you know, infantile spasms, it sounds like, is one that we should capture sleep. What other neurologic disorders should we know to try to capture sleep with?
I think if you're, in general, if you're concerned about epilepsy, many epileptiform abnormalities in brain activity come out around sleep-wake transitions. So I would say if you have a child or a patient who you're worried about epilepsy, you've done an awake-only EEG and not seen anything, it's very reasonable to move forward and get a sleep recording, just because you may see things that you don't see during wakefulness. Also, obviously, if you're dealing with nocturnal events of concern, which are often not seizures, they can be sort of different types of parasomnias or sleep behavioral disorders, then you also would want to capture sleep.
That makes sense. So just to kind of summarize, it sounds like, all right, we're ordering EEG, relatively low threshold to do so. If it's an infant less than one, infantile spasms or nighttime concerns, try to do a continuous one to capture sleep. If not, we can always do a spot, and if negative and still concerned for seizure, then we could do a longer one, which sounds like that would also capture sleep. Does that sound like a kind of good summary for this?
Yeah, I'd say that's a fair summary.
Okay, perfect. So let's put an EEG on this kid and see what happens. Juliana, if you wouldn't mind taking it from there.
Yeah, so an EEG is performed on Andrew, and he is found to have hypsarrhythmia. And so he's admitted to the neurology service for further workup and treatment. But wanted to ask you, Ava, if we could just have like a definition or an overview of what exactly are infantile spasms?
So infantile spasms are a subset of a type of seizure called epileptic spasms. Specifically, they refer to epileptic spasms that occur in children under the age of 2. And the reason that we sort of break out this particular group is because there's an entity, infantile epileptic spasms syndrome, that typically combines infantile spasms with the EEG pattern of hypsarrhythmia and often a developmental plateau or regression. Previously, this would be called West syndrome. So infantile spasms was first described by Dr. W.J. West in the UK in 1841. And he named it after him and really his son, because he drew attention of his colleagues to a rare and singular species of convulsions peculiar to young children. And so he does a beautiful description of infantile spasms and has stood the test of time even until now. And his son eventually went on to have significant intellectual disability, ongoing seizures, and I think passed away at a young age. And so the kind of classic syndrome is infantile spasm, so the seizure, hypsarrhythmia, and then the developmental regression or plateau. And the reason that we care about identifying infantile spasms is because if you treat them expeditiously and you resolve the seizures and the hypsarrhythmia, you can prevent, arrest, or reverse the developmental regression. And then the child has the best chance of having a good outcome, meaning normal development and not going on to have additional types of seizures.
And so a quick follow-up of the infantile spasms versus the infantile spasms syndrome. You know, it sounds like the syndrome includes the developmental regression and the hypsarrhythmia. Is the actual word infantile spasms, is that just colloquial? Do we just use that and really are trying to describe the syndrome, or is there, or can there be a difference between these two things?
This is one of those disorders, as so many neurologic disorders, that just gets renamed every couple of years. So it was originally called West syndrome. Then we went through a long and personally my favorite phase of just calling it infantile spasms. And now more recently, the International League Against Epilepsy, or ILAE, which is sort of our field's naming body, or convention, comes up with the conventions of different names of different disorders, has re-termed it infantile epileptic spasms syndrome, basically to rename West syndrome. And so you don't have to have all three components, although you can. And increasingly, because of early recognition, often children are presenting, like I said, within days of having onset of spasms, and they may not even have progressed to having hypsarrhythmia or developmental arrest or regression.
And then, you know, we're kind of almost there, but let's kind of complete this. How do we make the official diagnosis? For example, do you need to have hypsarrhythmia? Do you need to have the appropriate or the classic symptoms of your spasms themselves? And do you need to have developmental regression? Or are those things a spectrum, so to speak?
It's definitely a spectrum. I would say you need to have infantile spasms, the actual seizures themselves. I would not wait to treat a child to see if hypsarrhythmia emerges or developmental regression occurs. So if the child presents with spasms and your clinical kind of concern is high enough, if you see the movements, if you see video of the movements that are consistent, or if you catch them on EEG and see the classic EEG pattern, what's called an electrodecrement, or basically you see a big wave of slow activity and then a big dropout in the EEG activity, any of those would be reasons to proceed with treatment. So I've certainly treated kids for infantile spasms whose EEGs were sort of negative during the actual movements themselves, because clinically they are so consistent with spasms that we don't want to potentially risk having a delay in treatment.
So before we get to treatment, we're still in the workup phase. We're getting the EEG, and you have high suspicion, or at least you're, you know, making sure you're also hitting, ruling out other things at the same time. What are other things that we need to do on a workup? Do we need to get labs? Do we need to get chemistries? Do we need, like, what is your general workup that we also do besides the EEG? Or do we only need the EEG, and once we get that, we're like, slam dunk, I know what it is?
Typically, the other parts of the workup that you'll do, so assuming that you think this is infantile spasms, you'll get an MRI or a brain image. And that's to look for structural reasons that could lead to infantile spasms, and particularly also to screen for tuberous sclerosis. If there's findings consistent with tuberous sclerosis on the MRI, that will also impact your treatment plan. So it's important to have that sort of in the near term of diagnosis. And then the other thing that all these children now undergo is genetic testing. So usually we'll do whole exome sequencing. And part of the reason that's so important is that there are many different reasons why children can develop infantile spasms. And ultimately, the underlying etiology really drives the prognosis. So it's important to recognize them early. It's important to treat these children quickly and get the spasms under control. But whatever their underlying etiology is, ultimately, that's what's going to kind of drive their prognosis in terms of both development as well as future epilepsy risk. So to give you an example, if you have a child who had really significant hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy as a baby, even if you treat their infantile spasms, you know, after the first cluster, well, they're still a setup for having, unfortunately, negative developmental outcomes. The kids who do best are the cryptogenic or truly idiopathic ones, where we never find a reason. And those are the children who are most likely to respond and then go on to have good developmental outcomes and also not develop future epilepsy.
Yeah, I was just had another question about the pathophysiology along these lines. So it sounds like risk factors can be tuberous sclerosis. It can be what we would consider as a naive generalist, just the classic structural abnormalities that would cause seizures. And so therefore it's causing infantile spasms versus a different type of seizure. from a pathophysiology standpoint, is there something special that we should know about infantile spasm, or is this just a classification of a type of seizure? And honestly, if you have a brain issue, for example, say you have ischemia to one section of the left temporal lobe or something like that, or is that just going to, whatever seizure comes, comes, and it just is what it is? Or is there something special about infantile spasms that you have to have a certain setup for?
So infantile spasms is really a age and developmental dependent phenomenon. We do not know at this point why children will develop infantile spasms specifically, and why it's sort of a final common pathway for so many different etiologies. But it is a very age-limited syndrome, right? So it typically presents in kids 6 months to age two, and it can present, you know, because of many different regions, like you said, global brain injuries, focal brain injuries, underlying genetic etiologies. And so why all of these different things kind of come together to have this one seizure type is probably just something about the way that brain injury and the brain developing in that specific window interact. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. And it's perfectly good to say, look, we don't know this yet. But I like the fact that I'm not missing anything, but there's nothing that we need to know additionally. All right, Chris, sorry.
I do have one practical question. So you said you're sort of nebulous in like the urgency of getting the MRI. I guess one question I have is like, so say if a patient's inpatient already, you already had your TCEG, you diagnosed it, you know, based on, you know, by morning rounds, you saw a clustering of the seizures and you're like, well, they're already inpatient and I have a little baby that probably needs sedation to go to MRI. Does it make sense to get it done during that admission? Or is this something like you're more than willing to like take it nice and slow, get their MRI, or especially if, you know, you somehow got, they showed up in your outpatient neuro clinic because the pediatrician's like, I think this is going on. Mom brings to you the video. You're like, oh, these totally are infantile spasms. We should work on getting the EEG outpatient and getting an MRI. Like, can you talk about some of the practical things about the timing?
I would say typically these children are inpatient. It's pretty rare that we really have a new diagnosis outpatient who you then don't refer inpatient. That's part of that has to do with the EEG monitoring. Part of that has to do with the treatment and all the counseling and kind of monitoring that needs to go on with the treatment. It's just hard to do, you know, from an office visit. But I would say you'd want to get your MRI within like days to maximum 1 to 2 weeks.
And we've been kind of floating around treatment for a while. So I think this is a great opportunity just to kind of jump in. It sounds like urgent is important because developmental milestones are something that we're trying to progress and not stop. So what's our initial treatment? Can you kind of walk us through all the pieces?
The kind of indicated treatments in the United States are something called ACTH and vigabatrin, or I'll just say vigabatrin. That's the generic name. ACTH is similar to a steroid. And so we will often use prednisolone, which has been shown to basically be as effective as ACTH and much, 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 much cheaper. And so, and also easier to administer. It's a oral medication instead of an injection. And so many centers will vary whether they're an ACTH center or a pred center. Where I practice, it's typically we do prednisolone. So that's a high-dose steroid course. You do 2 weeks of high dose and then typically about a three-week taper off. And that's to reduce adrenal suppression. Vigabatrin is an anti-seizure medication that was initially used in adults but then found to be particularly effective for infantile spasms and particularly effective for children with tuberous sclerosis who developed infantile spasms. So usually when you have a new diagnosis of infantile spasms, you are starting them either on prednisolone, ACTH, or vigabatrin.
And so we're going to ask some of these nuanced questions because we actually do like to know specific dosages and times and things like that because it can help us. I mean, in this case, it sounds like mostly doing with a pediatric neurologist, but you know, for us, it makes us understand maybe side effects, things like that. So for starters, high dose, what is high dose to you? So what dosages can you do of the pred? And do you do any of these things at the same time or do you do one then the other?
Prednisolone, we usually dose according to something called the UCAS protocol, which refers to a study that was done in the UK. I don't remember when that was done, many years ago. And it is basically it's flat dosing. So it's 10 milligrams four times a day for 2 weeks and then a taper. Vigabatrin, you typically will dose 150 milligrams per kilogram. It takes you, you go up to that dose slowly over the course of usually about a week or so, but it's 150 milligrams per kilogram per day divided into two doses. I actually don't use ACTH very much, so I don't know the ACTH dosing off the top of my head. It's basically, it's based on body surface area. And there's an online calculator that I've used a few times I've done it. Side effects. So with both ACTH and steroids, you tend to have side effects like increased appetite, immunosuppression, potentially increased bleeding risk, hypertension, hyperglycemia, increased infection risk, I already said immunosuppression, irritability. Those are kind of the major ones. Vigabatrin is an anti-seizure medication. It can make you sedated and sleepy. It often makes kids really low tone or floppy. So certainly in kids who are already low tone, sometimes I've had it where it's impacted their feeding, where it's impacted their breathing. The kind of big warning that we have to give everyone with vigabatrin is that they've found that especially with extended exposure, you can have injury to the cells in the retina, and it can impact peripheral vision. So you can be associated with peripheral vision loss. And so we have to do all of this counseling. It has a REMS program that you have to sign everyone up on, and they have to be referred to ophthalmology for recurrent vision exams while they're on the medication. Practically speaking, actually, it's probably not very high risk. In terms of vision loss, it affects peripheral vision, not central vision. So you think about it, it's like maybe your blind spot would be a bit bigger. And when you're balancing that against sort of the very serious diagnosis like infantile spasms, where you really want to get the seizures under control because that can impact development, I think for the most part, when I speak with families, they recognize that that goal is sort of a higher benefit than the risk for potentially vision loss if the child were to be on it for years and years and years. Vigabatrin also can sometimes cause some changes on the way that the MRI appears. Usually we don't scan kids after they're on vigabatrin. Usually they're getting scanned before. But sometimes if we do end up having that, radiology gets excited. They say it could be a metabolic disease, but it's not. It's just vigabatrin. And usually if you scan them afterwards, it's gone away. There was a big push for a while to use them together called combination therapy. There were a couple of studies out of Europe that looked at this. They did find when they were used in combination that children had more rapid resolution of spasms. And so for a while we were, you know, everyone was sort of interested in combo therapy. But then actually when they follow these kids up several years later, they found no difference in outcomes in terms of development and future epilepsy risk. And so now most people, I think, have moved away from combination therapy because you're basically just getting more side effects without more benefit. Kind of the new vogue term is rapid sequential therapy. There was a study maybe about 2 years ago or 3 years ago now that showed that 80% of patients who are going to respond to a medication respond within the first week. And so the goal is basically you check in with a family after the first week, and if spasms are still ongoing, then you potentially switch to a different first line therapy. So if you were on Pred, you go up on the dose of prednisolone, and then you'll be ordering vigabatrin. If you're on vigabatrin, maybe you try Pred. And so that's kind of where the field has moved in, sort of using these medications in combination.
One of the things I've always appreciated about medicine is that you're never really done learning. Whether you're a medical student on your first rotation, a resident finding your footing, or years into practice like Chris and me, every day is another opportunity to learn something new. And if you're spending that much time in the hospital, having scrubs that are comfortable, durable, and actually look good makes a real difference. That's one of the reasons I've been a fan of Figs for years. And so, Cribsiders listeners, it's here, back to school season. And while that means lectures, labs, and late nights for healthcare workers in training, it's also a reminder that in medicine, education never really ends. And right now, Figs, the premium apparel brand for healthcare professionals, just dropped fresh colors and exclusive back to school styles. And the best part? Everything is 20% off site-wide for a limited time. From scrubs to outerwear to footwear and beyond, Figs keeps awesome humans looking sharp, performing their best, and ready to take on anything, from marathon lab sessions to 12-hour shifts. So if you're in healthcare or know someone who is, don't miss out on 20% off for back to school happening now through August 11th at wearfigs.com. That's wearfigs.com.
Now, do we ever run to a time when you have to treat these like in a more emergent setting, or like they become intractable, or you have to worry about respiratory compromise? And if so, are we doing like the typical stuff like benzos and things like that? Or is there a different way we should be approaching these patients?
So even though children can have clusters of spasms, that can go on for a long time, including longer than 5 minutes, which is our usual threshold in pediatric neurology for saying that you're in status epilepticus, a seizure emergency, and you should give a rescue benzo. Specifically for infantile spasms, we actually don't do benzo rescues, even for prolonged clusters. So most of the time, the cluster will end on its own. It does not typically, and ever in my experience, lead to respiratory compromise. And so this isn't something that we usually will treat with benzodiazepines.
And another follow-up question from kind of your expert opinion as well. You were mentioning when you're choosing between the anti-epileptic and the corticosteroid, tuberous sclerosis is maybe better from the anti-epileptic perspective. Is that generally what you do? Do you generally pick PRED as your go-to, as first line, unless they have tuberous sclerosis? Or is there another way to think about that?
Yeah, so I would say, and the data is somewhat controversial, that in general, prednisolone and ACTH are probably slightly more effective than vigabatrin, except in the TSC population. So my usual practice is I will do PRED as my first line. The children who sometimes we won't do PRED in are if they have a contraindication. So, for example, they already have hypertension or they're already very immunosuppressed and sick. And, you know, where their medical complexity would make a high dose steroid course potentially too dangerous. So sometimes those kids will do vigabatrin. Also, if there's an underlying etiology that we know is not going to change and we think that the child is, you know, even if they respond to prednisolone, is highly likely to relapse. It is a medication you can only be on for a month, right? So sometimes those patients will have a risk-benefit discussion with the family and say, okay, actually, we just think we should start vigabatrin because if they're going to respond, then they can actually stay on that medication for longer. Whereas if we do prednisolone, you're going to have potentially the spasms will go away, but the underlying, you know, condition is such that they're probably going to come back. And so we would rather do something that can kind of get them under control until the child has outgrown this particular developmental vulnerability.
Ava, we wanted to ask a little bit more about just general prognosis and counseling you give to parents who have new diagnoses of infantile spasms.
Yeah, so I would say that my my sort of general approach is initially is I usually try to emphasize to the family that they have correctly identified, you know, the underlying condition, that they rapidly sought care and that they have done everything possible to get their child the best outcome. Because I think that's something that's really important, especially for families who are in, frankly, a bit of a panic about what they read on the internet as an extremely serious diagnosis. So I think that's one thing that I try to provide reassurance for most of our families, where they're coming in a few days after the child has started having the spasms. The second thing is that so much of the counseling depends on the etiology that I generally reserve any sort of either very optimistic or very pessimistic counseling until we have a known etiology. So oftentimes, if there's already a known underlying condition like severe hypoxic ischemic encephalopathy or a pre-existing genetic condition, I say, you know, this doesn't necessarily change much, right? So this, while yes, we want to treat the seizures, you know, and get them under control, ultimately the child's trajectory is what it was going to be. And so this hasn't necessarily changed anything for better or for worse. If it's a situation where we can't find a underlying cause, like I said, that's usually the best prognosis. And so I usually try to tell parents both before the MRI and the genetic testing that, you know, not to be frustrated if we don't see anything, because it's actually the best case scenario is that we never find a reason, because those are the kids who tend to do the best. And so typically, you know, I try to have everyone just reserve any conclusions until we've gotten both the MRI and genetic testing results back. This is assuming we don't have a known etiology. And then kind of at that follow-up meeting, once we have those results and we see how the child has responded to the treatments, then we can have a more informed discussion about what to expect long-term. Also, kids who were normal, developmentally normal before onset of spasms tend to do better than kids who already had developmental delays. And certainly if the spasms resolve, the hips arrhythmia goes away, and the child's development picks up again, those are all reassuring factors to say going forward that we think we're going to do well. Unfortunately, probably only about 20 to 25% of kids with infantile spasms have a, quote, good outcome, meaning normal or near normal development, and not going on to develop future epilepsy.
And is there anything we can do to kind of push our patients into that 25% category, so to speak. It sounds like there's not much that we can change from a prognosis standpoint if it's underlying disease process, genetic, or you know, tuberous sclerosis, for example, that type of thing. But are there any things that we can do or any things that make things worse for patients to change their prognosis?
I think besides early identification and rapid treatment, the other thing I would say in general, and this is obviously going to be a situation where a child's probably being followed by a neurologist and certainly a neurologist and hopefully also an epilepsy specialist, depending on where they are in the country. So if the child is not responding to sort of the standard treatments and there are any clues about like potentially focal causes, to think about epilepsy surgery. So certainly if there's anything like a focal cortical dysplasia or, you know, for example, a hemimegalencephaly or a perinatal stroke, those are all things that are actually amenable to epilepsy surgery. And the child should proceed to epilepsy surgery rapidly if the spasms are refractory. There is also a procedure called a corpus callosotomy, which basically divides the corpus callosum or big connecting white matter bundle between the two hemispheres. This is something that increasingly is being used to treat refractory spasms. I don't think the data is there to support necessarily how much it helps with the developmental outcomes, but it certainly does have some benefit for refractory spasms. There's also the ketogenic diet, which can be used, and sometimes I've had patients respond really nice to the ketogenic diet. So you can kind of tinker with some medications, but like I said, really at the end of the day, the etiology is the big driver. And so, you know, treat quickly, change therapies quickly. If you're not getting a response, make sure you're thinking about epilepsy surgery candidacy. And then other than that, you know, let's all wait for the precision medicine revolution to solve all this for us.
So question for some of our patients. So say, say our patient here is treated for infantile spasms. Actually, we find no other etiology, MRI is normal, and happens to be one that may not progress into epilepsy long-term. Like, is this something that still will need to have, is it possibility to be weaned off medications entirely? Or is this something that we'd have to always worry about?
Yeah, I always sort of chuckle to myself because inevitably these are always the patients I staff with the residents. And the ones who I always get are the ones who end up being super refractory. So when I've talked to the residents, those kids always go on to do great. And eventually we discharge them from neuro care to live their hopefully otherwise wonderful lives. So yeah, so if they do prednisolone and they respond, they get treated with their prednisolone, their EEG is clean at the end of treatment, they never have recurrence of spasms, they just go on. Usually I'd say we'd follow them for a year or two, and then sometimes they'll get discharged if they're otherwise doing great. Vigabatrin, most people will tend to treat for 6 to 12 months. I tend to treat on the longer side because there's been some data to support that there's a lower relapse risk with longer treatment. But then, I usually check an EEG after they've been on it for about a year. We wean them off, and if no spasms come back, on they go. And usually, like I said, I follow them for another year or two just keep an eye on development, make sure the parents have a connection. But they always would come back anyway if they had concerns. But so there are kids who can kind of graduate from this. And actually, one thing I'd love to do some research on is taking a look at children who did well and what their sort of real long-term outcomes were many, you know, years to decades down the line.
Because I always wonder about these, you know, I'll have these pediatric patients, you know, they're 8, 9, 10, and we'll get the full history. It's like, oh, history of infantile spasms, but they're doing fine, not seeing neuro, not on medications. Like, do I need to worry about anything else? And it sounds like if they've graduated from neuro, then, you know, just monitor them normal. Fantastic.
I was actually wondering if I could just hit a follow-up question about that, because we were talking about how long the medications are, and and now I'm putting the two together, and I was thinking, so you do 4 weeks of steroids-ish, or about a month of steroids, as it sounds like what you do. It sounds like, when do you get a repeat EEG? And then if there are still spasms there, can you ever redose the steroids? Say they do, or, you know, and I'm giving you tons of examples off the bat, but you can kind of see where I'm going. The second one is, you know, their EEG looks clean afterwards, but then 6 months down the line, they have spasms again. Like, can you put them back on steroids or you know, what's your usual protocol for those types of patients?
Yeah. So all of these patients, so they get their EEG, hopefully a diagnosis, then they get an EEG at the end of 2 weeks. And that's kind of your other test for resolution. So ideally, a complete response would be resolution of clinical spasms and resolution of hips arrhythmia on EEG. And so that two-week EEG is meant to be your check-in point to see if there's any hips arrhythmia or subtle spasms that maybe family isn't seeing. So we make a diagnosis usually in the inpatient setting. I usually follow up with the patient either through the portal system by phone call or a video visit at 1 week mark. We sort of see clinically if spasms have resolved fine. We're going to wait for our EEG week two. If spasms are ongoing, I'm escalating or changing treatment. Once spasms have resolved, I tend to check an EEG, you know, about a month after the steroid wean is complete to see if any spasms have reemerged or if hips arrhythmia seems to be coming back or if there are other underlying epileptiform abnormalities that suggest this child could be a setup for either future epilepsy or relapse risk. So that's sort of what we do with EEGs. And there's not a lot of guidance beyond that two-week EEG. I would say different people do different things based on the specific patient. And then often, like I said, for vigabatrin, before I wean off, I usually will check another EEG.
So the steroid piece. So say, for example, you did get better. You know, if you didn't get better, we're changing drugs. That part we got. If you did get better, but then you either develop symptoms later on or you, maybe parents didn't even notice. So you were saying you found some kind of subclinical hips arrhythmia or something like that. Can you redose with steroids again since you saw a recovery to begin with, or do you have to switch drugs?
No, you can redose with steroids. So if someone responded to steroids and then they relapse like several weeks to months later, you can absolutely do another pulse of steroids and potentially then you can do like a slower taper. Again, most of this is not evidence-based. A lot of it is sort of practitioner dependent. And, you know, again, once you've hit a relapse, you're in a sort of higher risk category for being refractory. But yes, you can treat again with steroids, or you can try another agent, or you can do one and then the other. So there's no hard and fast algorithm, but it is sort of patient specific and also sort of what the parents want to do in terms of side effects and medication administration.
So one question I have is, you know, we've talked about diagnosis and treatment already. And one question I have is, so what type of disparities are we seeing in terms of like time to diagnosis or even treatment outcomes related to social determinants of health?
There is actually a lot of recent data that underserved populations and minoritized populations have worse outcomes. A lot of it relates to a diagnostic lag and also to them not receiving standard first-line therapies. And so I don't have a specific reason why that would be the case. I don't know if the studies, and I haven't reviewed them recently enough to remember, kind of go into that. But yes, certainly there are situations where those populations tend to do worse. I would also say in my own personal experience, I've had children who are in the foster care system. It's very hard to do effective infantile spasms care in the foster care system unless you have like an excellent foster parent who's has some stability and the child is with the same foster parent. I've had a negligible amount of children who present with infantile spasms and kind of concurrent with that, there's a separation from the birth family because of medical complexity issues and their ability to care for the child around this complex medical diagnosis. And that can be incredibly destabilizing for the treatment. So that's another sort of uniquely vulnerable population, I think, who can have a worse outcome because of those types of social determinants of health. Fortunately, though, PRED is very cheap. And so, you know, even for an uninsured patient, it's certainly achievable to dose them with PRED. Vigabatrin is usually covered by insurance because infantile spasms is the FDA indication. And then ACTH is extremely expensive. But as I said, I don't use very much of it. So,
well, Ava, thank you so much for talking to us today. As we wrap up the discussion today, I was wondering if you could give us a couple take-home points you want our listeners to have.
Yeah, and thank you so much for having me. It's been really great to get to talk about this topic. And I think any chance that we can raise awareness for infantile spasms, especially for pediatricians of all different specialties and general practitioners, is really important because it is one of those things that you're going to see and you don't want to miss. And so I'm glad to get to have this opportunity. So I think the big take-home points are, if you're ever concerned that something is a seizure, it's never wrong to get an EEG. So don't be shy. Please refer to neurology. We want to see these patients, and it is a reasonable ED referral as well. If your concern is infantile spasms, you just say your concern is infantile spasms. If the parent's concern is infantile spasms, don't feel like you have to hesitate. Just get the EEG, and it can get diagnosed or reassurance one way or another. The goal is early effective treatment. We want to treat these children typically within the first few weeks of presentation. And so that's sort of associated with the best outcome. And you want to make sure that you're following up with the family frequently after diagnosis to make sure the child is responding to treatment. Ultimately, prognosis is driven by etiology. And so understanding the underlying etiology is going to give you the best chance of offering correct counseling to parents. And then the last thing I'll say is this is a very underserved area of pediatric neurology because it's not sort of a focus of a lot of new drug development. And so this is something where I, always encourage people to advocate that infantile spasms needs to be studied. And we really need new medications and treatments because the ones we have are only so effective. And I think increasingly so much of this is going to be etiology driven as well with all of our new understanding of different genetic conditions and also hopefully how to treat them all in the next coming years to decades. So I say those are my big takeaway points for infantile spasms. I love taking care of this patient population. You become incredibly close with the family. It's a high intensity, very emotional time for them. And I think you as a provider can really guide them through an incredibly difficult journey, but one that I increasingly feel like we have reasons to be hopeful for. So I'm very grateful, obviously, to all of the parents and the patients who have let me learn so much about this disorder by working with them and to all the other docs who've sent me their infantile spasms patients.
Wonderful. And before we let you go, is there anything you'd like to plug you want our audience to check out? Maybe some groups or I think you listed a couple of different groups already or some websites or tools that you want them to check out?
Yeah, the TSC Alliance has a lot of good materials, patient-facing materials about infantile spasms. So they're a good group to look for. Obviously, I also always love the Epilepsy Foundation. I always want to put in also a plug for the Cure Epilepsy Foundation, which is a group I'm actually working on a project with right now on late onset epileptic spasms. So on children older than the age of 2 to develop this, which is a very poorly understood group. So please stay tuned for hopefully some research coming out about that group in the next couple of months. Other than that, just your friendly local neighborhood pediatric epileptologist.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. I learned so much from this episode. I'm sure our listeners did too. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
This has been another episode of the Cripsiders.
It's for the kids!
Get show notes on our website at www.thecripsiders.com.
We're committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts, or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks to our wonderful producer for this episode, Juliana, and our social media team, which is mostly Denise Cruz on X, Blue Sky, and Instagram. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Juliana Fan.
And this has been Chris the Chumanchi. Thank you and good night to you guys.